So getting back to the open session agenda, taking it up at item 9, this is the time that we have scheduled for an educational presentation on fiduciary issues presented by Fiduciary Counsel Harvey Lederman. So welcome.
Real quick, Harvey, sorry, before we go on. Hey, Scott, if you go to your video settings, and you should have a number of options there from default computer option to a specific camera. I don't know if you've tried that or not, but
I'll check that out. It was a question of difficulty in loading settings and whatnot. So I'll work on it. So with no further ado, Harvey, the floor is yours.
Ado, thank you. Karen, would you admit my partner, Maytek Chin? Have somebody do that?
She in the waiting room, I hope.
She should be in the waiting room. Yeah, I know she is. We can just take a moment.
There she is. Yeah, she's joining.
There we are.
Good morning, Maytek.
Well, good morning.
Yeah, thank you all. Annually, and you get this fantastic opportunity to hear from both outside counsel and your general counsel today, who's going to be following us up on the Brown Act presentation. You know, in the past, when we've had this conversation, we've really focused on conflicts of interest portion of your fiduciary responsibilities, but I guess I'm going to offer you a compliment. This board is quite remarkable in that I can't remember more than one or two instances over the past decade, at least, where this board has had to face a real conflict of interest for one of its board members or staff that have really posed some issues. That's not the case in other boards, I can assure you. And so I think today what we're going to do, Maytek and I would like to go back and focus on the fundamental fiduciary responsibilities, the five of them that we have, and really talk about why do we have these fiduciary responsibilities, and then have a general discussion of any questions that come up at the time. So why don't we, Maytek, if you'll kick this off with the first series of slides, and then I'll pick up a little bit later and see how this goes. Thanks so much.
Sure. Thank you, everyone, for having me. Can everyone see my screen?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. So we're going to start off with the five fundamental fiduciary duties that are set forth in the California Constitution, Article 16, Section 17, which are the primary loyalty rule, the exclusive benefit rule, the duty of prudence, and the duty to diversify, and lastly, the duty to follow the plan's terms. Now, while there are five fundamental fiduciary duties, the duty of loyalty is the duty that takes precedence over all other fiduciary duties. And so we can think of the duty of loyalty as the primary loyalty rule. And this rule requires the board to act in the best interest of the members and beneficiaries and not to promote any personal interests or any other interests for any other special interest group. The next fiduciary duty we have is the exclusive benefit rule. And the exclusive benefit rule requires the board to use the plan assets for only two purposes. One, to pay benefits when due, and two, to pay reasonable administrative expenses and costs. And so one thing I want to note regarding the exclusive benefit rule on the reasonable administrative expenses and costs, that further imposes on the board a duty to conduct its due diligence to ensure that the plan is doing so. Third, we have the duty of prudence. The duty of prudence imposes a heightened standard of care on the trustees, where it requires the board to act as a knowledgeable, prudent person would under those similar circumstances and with as a person who would charged with similar duties as the board is here. Then we move on to the duty of diversification. The duty of diversification requires the board to diversify the portfolio of investments to minimize risks and to maximize returns unless clearly not prudent to do so. Now, the reason why we have the duty to diversify is related to our duty of loyalty to the members, which is the duty to diversify helps the plan spread out its risks and returns so that the plan has enough assets in the long run to pay out benefits when due. Lastly, we have the duty to follow the plan documents. It's important to note here that this duty is related to the plan, the board as plan administrator. We are responsible for the administration of the plan, but not the design. So it is important for us to follow the plan's design, which is set forth in the Constitution, the SURL, the Internal Revenue Code and related regulations, our board regulations, charters, and policies. Oh, one more thing I wanted to note with regards to following the plan's documents. It's also important for us to follow the plan documents to maintain our tax qualified status as a plan. So let's drill into the duty of loyalty. So within every public pension system, there are a number of stakeholders who are invested in the operations of the retirement plan because they're invested in the plan in some sort of way. So the various stakeholders, for example, in SACERA are our members and beneficiaries, participating county and districts, the unions, retiree organizations, the general public at large, taxpayers, our consultants and vendors. Now, under the California Constitution, as I mentioned earlier, the duty of loyalty requires us to put the members and beneficiaries' interests above all else. So the members and beneficiaries take precedent over all other stakeholders. Now, when exercising your duty of loyalty, one of the questions you should ask yourself when conducting board business is whether the conduct or action that the board is seeking to take is in furtherance of the members and beneficiaries' best interests. So what does it mean to be loyal? Now, this board is an interested board. You do not serve in a representative capacity. So no matter how you ended up on the board, once you're seated as a trustee, you owe a duty to the membership at large and the plan, meaning you have a constituency of one, which is the membership and members and beneficiaries in the plan, excuse me. I always get tongue-tied on the word constituency, and then it kind of throws me off a little. So apologies for that. One of the best ways to ensure that you're meeting your duty of loyalty is to avoid conflicts of interests. Some of the common conflicts of interest to avoid are serving the interests of others, your own personal financial interests, accepting gifts that could influence you. And one other thing I want to note is that SACERA has its own fiduciary code of conduct and the fiduciary code of conflicts and ethics, which we have also attached with your agenda. So please review that in terms of reviewing possible conflicts and the processes and the scope of what SACERA has laid out for guidelines for this board. Now, if you do have a conflict of interest or any question of a conflict of interest, please contact counsel, either Karen, Harvey, or I, to discuss it. And if there is indeed a conflict, you have a duty to recuse yourself from the board's actions so that the board can continue to take action without the conflict. Now, another thing I want to note is that you owe a duty to your fellow colleagues here, the other trustees who also sit in the board. And the reason being is because there are several trustees who sit in the board. However, you all serve as fiduciaries together as a board. And therefore you owe it to each other to develop a sense of trust amongst yourselves that if there is a conflict of interest, that the trustee with the conflict would disclose it and recuse themselves for the sake of the entire board. So here is a quote from the US Supreme Court on the issue of on duty of loyalty issues. And I'm just gonna read it out because I think it is a good quote to take away. So an employee benefit fund trustee is a fiduciary whose duty to the trust beneficiaries must overcome any loyalty to the interest of the party that appointed him. Now there's a distinction between the process by which a person is appointed to office and the manner in which he performs that office after he has been appointed. Now this is a common area of tension for members who have been appointed by a certain special interest group to the board. They often feel that they have a duty to serve the special interest group that appointed them to the board. However, I want to caution the duty of loyalty requires you to take a step back and remember that once seated as a trustee, your duty is to the plan at large, all the members and beneficiaries, not to the special interest group that appointed you. Now we have a Supreme Court case called Lexin that deals with the duty of loyalty and conflicts of interests. And here it states that a person cannot serve two masters simultaneously if a public official is pulled in one direction by his financial interest and another direction by his official duties. His judgment cannot and should not be trusted, even if he attempts impartiality. Now, the takeaway point here is if there is a conflict, if you attempt impartiality, no matter how goodwilled you were in taking the action, the existence of the conflict does not cure the impartiality does not cure the conflict. So what else does it mean to be loyal? Now, we've talked about impartiality and the duty of loyalty with the plan over here and then other interests over here. I want you to take the lens of those two concepts and look at the membership at within the concept of just the membership, within the membership. Now, by the plan's nature, the plan is an intergenerational fund. We serve both active and retired members, and active and retired members may have differing interests from time to time. And so the board has a duty of impartiality to balance all the members' interests, both retired and active, to try to strive for to be fair over the long run, to do what's best and equitable to the best of their abilities. Now, to do that, it's quite difficult to find the right balance between active and retired members or otherwise. So the courts have given the board discretion in how best to balance those interests. Because the board is in the best position to understand the intricacies of how those interests interplay. So what does it mean to be prudent? The duty of prudence really focuses on the deliberative process. Now, good process matters more than good results. And I want to reiterate that. Good process matters more than good results. And so it's imperative that the board, when it does conduct, take action, that it deliberate, evaluate, and more importantly, document its deliberations throughout the process so that it can build a record to defend any abuse of discretion allegations later on down the line. The duty of prudence also imposes a heightened standard on the board, meaning that you are expected to be knowledgeable on all necessary components for plan administration. And the duty of prudence counsels that if you do not have an expertise, certain area of expertise, that you go out and get it and you delegate to someone who does. However, when you do delegate that authority, your fiduciary duty follows with the delegation. So the individual that you have delegated the duty to, they will also have the same fiduciary duty of prudence and other fiduciary duties as you would. However, the duty, if you do decide to delegate, there is a duty to monitor that delegation. And so the duty to monitor requires that you check in periodically and adjust to determine if that delegated authority is appropriate regarding scope, time, etc. So there's no set and forget once you've delegated. Now, again, good process matters more than good results. So as long as the board acts in a prudent manner, it diligently considered all options, it considered all risks, it heard from all stakeholders, it had a deliberative process going in, that will guard against a liability for breach of fiduciary duty, because the board, even if the choices turned out to be less than ideal in 2020 hindsight. So to illustrate that point, there is a case called Pleaf, where there investment decisions were turned out to be less than ideal in 2020 hindsight. And the question for the court there was whether or not the trustees of the plan had exercised their duty of prudence despite the outcomes in that case. And so the court found it persuasive that in taking consideration of the losses and the opportunities for gain, in addition to the considerations of the plan, the portfolio's diversification, liquidity, projected returns relative to the plan's funding objectives, and also that they engaged in deliberative and reasoned decision making, that they had met their duty of prudence. They met for over 2 years, a number of times. They had done the risk assessments, the pros and cons, and they weighed it all, and how that weighed in favor of them exercising their duty of prudence and therefore meeting their fiduciary duty, despite the fact that the investment returns turned out to be less than ideal in 2020 hindsight. So to bring it back to a California case, if you want to consider the duty of prudence in a Searle system, one example is from the O'Neill v. Stansera case, which I understand we presented to you last year during our fiduciary training. So I'm not going to go through all the facts of the case at the moment. However, the key takeaways from the O'Neill case that on the duty of prudence is, one, seek expert advice from actuaries, counsel, and consultants. Again, if you don't have the expertise for a necessary component for plan administration, the duty of prudence counsels you to go out and get it and to delegate that authority to someone who does have that expertise. Second is to hold open and public meetings and invite all stakeholders to participate. You want to hear from all sides to understand the full scope of the issue to help give dimension to the board action under consideration. Gather all relevant facts and consider all reasonable options. Again, the deliberative process and evaluation. And remember that your primary duty of loyalty is to the members. Again, when taking board action, always consider whether the board action will be in furtherance of the members and beneficiaries' best interests. And lastly, document and record all proceedings. Again, this is related to the building of a record to defend any board action against any alleged breach of fiduciary duty or abuse of discretion. And with that, I'm going to turn it back over to my colleague, Harvey.
You know, I want to emphasize the very difficult job, if you haven't already noticed it, that's been bestowed upon you as board members in talking about delegation. I mean, there's a recognition that even though you are personally held to a very high standard of being knowledgeable about the things that impact the system, that it's a recognition that this is not your daytime job. This is not your full-time job. You know, even because of the strictures of the Brown Act, you can't do what private boards do. You can't talk to each other about the business of the board outside the boardroom, except for a few instances of closed session. You have to conduct your meetings, and you meet, you know, this board meets twice a month. There is no way that a fiduciary board that meets twice a month can have their fingers on all the operations of a $12 billion pension fund. You have to delegate to people, to staff, to outside experts, and then to monitor and make sure they're carrying out your responsibilities. But it's a very dicey business, actually, because you're held to a high standard. And the idea is that you're given the tools to discharge your responsibilities under that high standard if you act prudently, and that you're going to be given wide latitude in making judgments as long as those judgments are educated, thorough, and keep the best interests of the members and beneficiaries at stake. So those first three fiduciary responsibilities that Maytag has taken us through are really the core on which your conduct as a collective board making collective decisions for the plan take place. Let's flip over. I want to talk about the last two, the last but not least. Why we have, let's go to slide 13. There we go. So the fourth duty that was in the list at the beginning of the slide deck was the duty to diversify. This is pretty unusual. We work with boards across the country, and there are many states where there is no imposed fiduciary duty to diversify the portfolio. This is pretty unique to California. In a few other states, Ohio is similar, Illinois is similar, New York is not. The duty to diversify really came about because up until, what do we have, maybe 30 years ago, I guess that's now 40 years, isn't it?
Yeah. It's getting close.
40
closer
years.
To 40.
40 years. You know, up until that time, the management of the assets of our systems like Cicero were basically being run out of the desk drawer of the county treasurer. County treasurer was authorized to invest in bonds and overnight paper, and that's it. The assets of the retirement system, the contributions that came in from employers and employees, basically were put into bonds, and the job of the treasurer in managing the fund was what they used to call clipping coupons, which they actually did physically, and redeeming interest-bearing coupons on bond issues. That was the responsibility. That was the only ability that boards had up until 1984 to invest. They could not invest in the equity markets. Prop 21 passed that year. It was very controversial, but it allowed for the first time the boards like this to invest across the entire spectrum of public markets. There wasn't a lot of talk about private markets at the time either, by the way. But because of that, there was a concern that trustees like yourselves might gamble, might push all your chips into risk-taking assets. And that might be imprudent, and you could, and that would have been done at the risk of your plan sponsors, the county, for example, who, because of a defined benefit plan, is the backstop in the event there aren't enough assets to pay benefits. So Prop 21 also put in this concept of the requirement to diversify the portfolio. And let's talk about that in the next slide for a moment, slide 14. You've all seen this. This is the so-called, what they call the efficient frontier, right? And Varys will come in and talk to you about this. And this is the theory. This is modern portfolio theory on which Prop 21 was based, and your responsibility to diversify is based. And the idea is simply that you have two axes, risk and return. And as you go further out on the risk curve, if you will, you should be able to expect a higher return. So if you put your cash in the bank or you only invest in short-term treasuries, your risk on the x-axis, the horizontal axis, should be almost zero. But of course, your return is going to be similar to that. It's not, because the theory is that riskier assets pay off more and that you should be able to get a higher return the more risk that you take. That's the theory. Now, so if you look at on this curve, for example, large cap value stocks, large cap growth stocks, they're kind of in the middle of the risk curve and they're pretty high up on the return axis on the other side. So the expectation is that if you diversify in your assets in all of these investments, that you're somehow going to get a balanced risk adjusted return to grow the assets of the system. We look to investment returns to produce 70%+ of the value of the assets in the system to pay the benefits. On the next slide, however, you can see, if you can read that, I'm not sure you can read it too well on the screen, but you can't see my cursor on the screen, can you?
No, but I can point where you want.
Well, let's just take a look. This is modern portfolio reality. This is how those assets actually perform over a 20-year period, courtesy of Calvin Investments. And Maytag, if you hit your cursor down in the very lower corner on the left, you see in 2002, large cap equity lost 22%. And 4 or 5 years later, look where large cap equity is. It's bouncing all over. That's the dark blue over the last 20 years. Large cap equity bounces. It doesn't just sit at, you know, a medium risk, medium return level. It's bouncing all over the actual performance charts. So the idea is that over a long period of time, diversification will give you the returns that and the risk-adjusted returns that you want, and that there's really no other way to dampen volatility than to do it through diversification of your portfolio. Because if you just said, if you went back to slide 14 and picked out, well, I like the standard deviation of large cap value and large cap growth. Why don't I just push all my chips into there and let it ride? Well, it would ride probably over a 20-year period just fine. If we go back and look at it, the theory will work. But you could not handle the volatility of having all your chips in large cap equity over that period of time. It would wreck havoc on your investment portfolio and your cash flow and your ability to deliver the benefits that you owe to your members. But this is why the voters of the state of California decided that if they're going to delegate this much responsibility to you to invest and grow the assets of the system for the benefit of the members and their benefits, that diversification over a long period of time is going to be the only safe way to go about it. And so the Constitution says you have an obligation to diversify the assets unless it is clearly not prudent to diversify. And there's really never been a demonstration that I'm aware of over all these decades of someone finding that non-diversification or that diversification was imprudent. We went through a year like last year, where we thought the bond market was not going to be correlated and it was a safe balance to be in the bond market and in the equities market. And it turned out everything was correlated and everything crashed at the same time. But that, if you look at it over a period like this 20-year period in the Callan chart, you can see how it will in fact balance out to the theory. All right, enough with diversification. The next question is, we seem to have lost the heading on this slide. It's probably in your slide deck. The heading is simply, why do we bother? Why are we obligated to follow the plan documents? And as Maytag said earlier, it's very important. We have to recognize our role. We didn't design, this board did not design the pension plan for Contra Costa and the 12 or 15 districts that participate in the plan. The benefit formulas, the vesting requirements, the optional settlements, all those things that are in our plan were designed by the state legislature and by the county of Contra Costa. We administer the plan that they designed. So we have an obligation to follow that design. Our discretion is not to depart from the design. Our discretion is to interpret the terms of the design of the plan and the plan formulas and to administer them in a fair and reasonable way to our members and beneficiaries. So there is a clear obligation and a recognition both in the Constitution and in the CERL that we administer a plan that somebody else designed for us. We are, as Maytag also alluded to, this plan depends upon it being a governmental tax-exempt plan under the Internal Revenue Code. Our contributions that are made are pre-tax by the employees. The earnings of the system are not taxed either the federal or state level. In order to maintain that tax-qualified status, however, the IRS requires us to closely adhere to the plan that's been given to us. And when we don't adhere to it, we have what the IRS lovingly calls operational failures or operational errors. And they give us a very, very strict approach on how to correct those errors and to adjust benefits. And that's why from time to time, we find ourselves, because most systems are run by people and they're only human, we find sometimes we've overpaid benefits and sometimes we've underpaid benefits. And the IRS says, when you discover that, you need to correct it backwards and forwards, and you need to make the plan whole. You either need to recover money that was paid out wrongly or pay out more than you paid because you didn't follow the plan, whether it was inadvertent or intentional. So that's, and you'll get a lot of latitude in making those decisions. But the IRS is pretty strict with that, despite the fact that I don't think there's anybody left at the IRS anymore whose job it is to oversee governmental plans. We went through this worry about a decade ago where the IRS was looking over CSERA, and we all had, and all the other pension funds, and they all had to file with the IRS their plan documents. I don't think there's personnel at the IRS any longer whose job it is to do this, but we do have a lot of regulations that we dare not fail to follow because we cannot jeopardize the tax-exempt status of the plan. So that's the last of the fiduciary responsibilities that you have. There are in the future, the next slide, Maypak, there are always going to be what we call hot button issues that are going to test your commitment to these fiduciary responsibilities. This board has been through cycles as well as every other board. When the markets put a squeeze on your county and district budgets, it's very possible with threatened recession in the future and inflation that we could be imposing on those budgets again. So it's very important to maintain. There was a little picture of one of our first slides of a gyroscope. That's just to underscore the idea that you must remain balanced in how you go about funding the system through all these various cycles that impact your plan sponsors' budgets. Fees that you pay, Maytag mentioned that we are only allowed to pay reasonable expenses of administration. There's been a lot of attention about private equity fees that are being collected, and are the fees commensurate with the results that you're getting? Are you paying for alpha that you don't really get? There's been a lot of fee litigation in the private sector plans, like, you know, 401k plans, especially for some reason, the plaintiff's bar got a hold of the university plans and started challenging the payment of fees and the administration of those systems. There's no reason why that might not come to our governmental plans as well. So there is a tension, you know, that we have to report every year on the fees that we pay to our alternative investment managers. The threat of litigation is real. So one of the things to be aware of is, are you getting the bang for the buck that you're paying for? Are the fees relative and related to the performance for the plan that you're contracting for? A lot of conversation, too much conversation, frankly, at both the state and national level on ESG and diversity and inclusion values. How do we reconcile those values with your duty of loyalty to the plan? We could do a whole program on that. Maybe we should, if this becomes something of interest to the board this year. talk about how do you whether and how do you integrate environmental, social, and governance, corporate governance issues that may have an impact on the portfolio in the future. How do you integrate those into your investment process? And then finally, there's always this temptation, especially if you're outperforming your peers, to look at other peer performance and try to measure yourself off of that, and wondering, you know, why are others who are invested only in the S&P 500 look like they're doing so well, whereas we have this highly sophisticated portfolio? Are we doing the best we can? It's a good touchstone, but be careful about comparing yourself with other peers, especially on a short-term basis. With that, I think if there are any questions, Maytag and I are happy to address them. But we hope this has been eye-opening, perhaps, and kind of get you reoriented on the fundamental fiduciary responsibilities that you take on when you volunteer to be part of a board like this. Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you, Harvey. Thank you, Maytag. Are there any questions, Harvey or Maytag? I'm looking here on my gallery view. Do you mind not sharing your screen, Harvey? It makes it, I'm a klutz at this. Thank you.
Yeah, there we go.
Much easier for me to see the playing field. John, yes, you had your hand up.
Yeah, the last slide included equity. What is equity?
Last slide included equity.
Yes.
Yeah, let me just share my screen one more time so we can
sure.
Diversity, equity, and inclusion.
Equity. And I thought you were talking about private equity. All right.
Well, I'm what is D-E-N-I. That equity?
DE&I is an acronym for diversity, equity, and inclusion. And it's the idea that in an organization, whether it's this organization or ones that you invest in, that people are treated fairly and equitably, given opportunities across the board. That's just one of the values that people believe. You may hold this belief or not, but many people believe that entities that recognize and attract diverse talent that are treated equally and feel included in the corporate atmosphere and in the opportunities for advancement, for example, that companies like that perform better than those who fall short on those measurements. And that would go for both, you know, in this case, the Cerberus own operations, but it would also go for those companies that you invest your dollars with. There is a strong belief held by many players in the market that companies that have strong diversity, equity, and inclusion values and perform on that basis actually produce greater shareholder value than those who fall short on those measurements. So that's what the E is, means equitable treatment for employees.
And the way that might be measured?
Well, that's subject to debate currently amongst the ESG field. There are a lot of different scorecards that investment managers sometimes use. Companies also use their own scorecards. But we, like, as Harvey mentioned, we could do a separate fiduciary training on ESG and DE&I issues, because at the end of the day, investing in any investment decisions, regardless if it involves ESG, DE&I, it all has to come down to not a policy decision, but whether or not the investment decision is the best for the fund in terms of reaping its returns.
Measurements are very difficult in this area, of course, and one of the things that the market has been attempting to do is to drive some metrics by which these values or these factors can be measured uniformly. That's going on quite actively right now in the marketplace. try to come up with some standard metrics for these things. One of the things that, and I don't mean to digress too much, John, this might be more than you really asked, but diversity goals, a lot of pension funds, both in California and elsewhere, when they conduct competitive bidding, whether it's for services or for investments, there's a tendency to at the boards to want to score diversity metrics in those that they are hiring. In other words, if you have two managers in a particular sector and one has strong diversity values and the other does not, can you select one based on that comparison? We have some laws in California that say that in the public sector, you may not consider protected classes, race, creed, nationality, sexual orientation, et cetera, that you cannot score those in making your decisions. But then we have many pension funds that look at and ask their vendors and prospective managers to describe to them how they go about assuring that their workforce is diverse, is treated equitably, and that the people feel included in their culture. It is I liken it to quicksand. It's made more difficult in California than it is elsewhere because of California's laws, but it's still a topic that has not yet set well, and primarily because two things. One, we don't have very good metrics for it. And two, we don't have enough experience with being able to test whether the value proposition is valid. That is, companies, you know, the value proposition is companies with strong values in this regard perform financially better than other companies who do not have strong values. We don't have measurable results to really test that yet.
So Harvey, on that point though, is, at least with respect to publicly traded companies, isn't the metric how they do? I mean, isn't that the fundamental metric?
Well, it is, but the issue is with those. How would you ask Amazon to report to you and measure its level of commitment to diversity, equity, and inclusion? And would that be the same reporting that you might add, that you would want from Walmart, for example, or General Motors? And how do we mix that? There's no easy way to measure, to quantify, and compare corporate behavior in this regard.
Right, but what I'm saying is, if the question before the House is meeting the plan's obligations to produce the requisite rate of return or higher to meet our liability, right? And if amongst, again, I'm saying this with respect to publicly traded firms, because that's wherein there's a publicly published market and set of results. Right? If one firm professes to embrace DEI, ESG values and X, Y, and Z, and we compare it to another firm that either is silent on it or we don't know, isn't the metric that we have to use in the public marketplace, though, in terms of securing return, what the published return is, right? They have to report earnings. They their stock has a valuation that the market has placed on it. Isn't that the measure, all things being equal, in the public market?
Well, we don't know if we can attribute it to that difference, however. We don't know if we can isolate this factor from all their other factors, whether they, you know, have modern facilities, for example, whether they advertise their products in a certain way, et cetera. In other words, the question is, can we hold everything else equal and only measure the commitment to DE&I?
Yeah. Well, if I may chime in, I think a lot of the ESG and DE&I conversations occur in various levels. So for one, like Harvey mentioned, it's a governance issue, whether or not the company is governed in a way that attributes and meets these principles. Another way that ESG and DE&I values are considered in investment decisions is, does it provide or address an externality that's not currently priced into the asset? And so to your question about the public equities, they should, on the assumption that the public equities price should already have priced in some of these issues. Now, if we're talking about a different asset class, let's say real estate, your real estate investment manager may have ESG considerations, which are environmental. So is this the rainfall of this agricultural asset that you're getting into, does climate change affect them in certain ways? So one of the things I want to instill regards to ESG and DE&I values when we talk about investment decisions is that we need to also consider in the field of duty of prudence. We have to check with our managers, are you doing ESG? And if so, what are you doing to capture it? We have a duty to know what they're doing on that front, if anything, without having to impose one way or the other. We should be educated on these issues and be able to monitor them if they are employing such things. Because again, at the end of the day, we're interested in investment returns for the fund so we can meet our primary duty of loyalty to pay out the benefits. So
that's our current policy. I mean, as we sit here today, our investment policy is that we are chasing the highest returns in the public and private marketplaces.
And that's our primary duty of loyalty. And yeah. So, you know, it's a very intricate and complex issue, ESG and DE&I issues. And it may be, I don't want to take up too much of your time. I know you have a very long agenda, but it may be worth another presentation.
Yeah, it may be, but I also think it's a cottage industry, unto itself. And anyway, I don't want to get off on that tangent. Dennis, you've been patient. You had your hand.
Yes, just have a question based on what Harvey mentioned, that we did not design the plan. We basically interpret what legislature and like state and the county legislatures designed for us. But I have a question based on that. How come different pension systems are allowed to interpret it differently? Like, for example, PEPRA right now, right, which operates, that's the latest legislature for all the people hired after 2013. So different systems include, for example, different items in the pensionable compensation. How is it allowed? Isn't it supposed, should be like some kind of higher level of, I don't know, like somebody to judge what's allowed and what's not, because it seems like it's not fair. Some systems allow certain compensation items and some not. And both of them are not both, all of them are based on the same law.
That's because, Dennis, that despite the brilliance that characterizes our state legislature, there is no way that anybody has been able to write a law so clear that it's not subject to interpretation. And so, but there's also baked into our law, our county employee retirement law of 1937, some duality. In other words, we're allowed to fill in the blanks or to interpret some of the language. And various counties, even though there are core formulas, for example, that everybody is bound by, different counties and districts get to elect and choose and patch together different approaches and different formulas, for example, and different funding decisions, how much, you know, how long to amortize the unfunded liability, for example. So there's a lot of latitude granted to our boards in each difference, whether difference in CalPERS or in one of our county systems. The core provisions are there, but we're allowed to fill in a lot of the blanks. And quite frankly, this is, you know, MATAC and I have made our careers on having to litigate on your behalf areas of the law that are just simply not clearly stated. And we have to take our best shot at trying to figure out what do they mean. And this comes up all the time, and it came up in the AB 197 litigation, you know, when PEPR went into effect. And we had statewide litigation, went all the way up to the California Supreme Court to figure out what did the legislature really mean to do when it changed the law in 2013. It simply wasn't clear enough. So yes, there's some local control that's granted to you and to every county. But then there's the really tough job that you have and every other board in California has, which is to try to look at the language of this law and put it in context and interpret it for your members. And it's not going to be uniform across systems. You'll go to the CalPERS conference in a couple of weeks and you'll ask them, well, what do they do about this issue or that issue? And you'll hear 12 different approaches to it. Happens to us all the time. We go to the attorney breakout sessions and we say, how is your county, how is your system handling this? We get 5 different answers. So it's just baked into the system that we have. You're right. CalPERS says certain number of things are pensionable under the very same law that we may say, nope, only 6 of those are pensionable. It's frustrating, I understand.
Because what I'm also thinking, if you apply also our duty, the highest duty of loyalty to our members and beneficiaries, one could argue that we should be the most liberal in applying what's pensionable, not the other way around.
That's
and
why
it seems like CalPERS is kind of following that duty. And
interesting.
That's my question.
But that's why this is a board making a collective decision. And so you kick these ideas around and you come up to a collective decision on that. There are other systems like the New York State system where you got the controller runs the whole show. He's the only trustee. He makes the decision. But the way we're designed is to make a collective decision and weigh the pros and cons and do it in a prudent manner.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it just seems like by nature, all the interpretations are very subjective, right? So depending who is doing the interpreting. So it seems like it should be some higher power that basically says, yes, that interpretation is right and that interpretation is wrong.
But, and that's what's happened in many instances. It goes up to the courts and, the rule of law that we follow is that ultimately the courts will tell you whether you interpreted it right or you didn't interpret it right, according to them. and then if the people don't like what the courts decide, then they go back to the legislature and change the law and say, despite what the court said, we're going to make the law different. So, very dynamic process.
Yeah.
Not always satisfactory.
Yeah, I would add that the real balancing starts here. Hopefully we find a group of 9 or 12 that have a consensus on a viewpoint. If not, it's certainly got to be at least 5 who think that in order to achieve a majority in terms of thinking. And then that becomes the implementation of the rule, the policy. At that point, does it get challenged? Does the court have the last say under our system? It does. And as we've known from time to time, courts don't always see it the same way we do, but at other times they in fact do. So the court is the last arbiter But the primary decision and where the balancing takes place, and the legislature, I think, recognized that in the terms of how we compose or how these boards are comprised, is right here. So,
thank you.
Harvey, Maytak, any other questions for them? Looks like a quiet group today.
Right before lunch. Well, thank you guys all for having us.
Well, thank you. Thanks for being here, Maytak. Thank you, Harvey, as always.
You bet.
Bye. All right. Excellent.